What I want to do tonight is walk through, at a very high level, some of the areas that I think are relevant when you're starting a business and considering raising funding. So the introduction we've done. The first question really is, should you seek investment at all? Some businesses are suitable for investment from external money, some are not. Then I want to talk a little bit about the process of raising that funding, raising that investment, a little bit about preparing yourself for that, those series of conversations and then pitching to investors. I'll talk a little bit about the basics of investment, some of the mechanics of things like term sheets and structuring deals and shares and preferred shares and ownership and all that sort of stuff. And then I hope, if I get my timing right, that at the end we'll leave 15 minutes or so for questions. And then I think we have a networking reception at 6:30. So I'm going to have to go fast to stay on time. Maria talked a little bit about me, but she didn't really talk very much about my firm, Accel. Some of you may know us, some of you may not, but I'll bet you know a number of the companies up there. Facebook, Groupon, Dropbox, I wouldn't be surprised to find that many of you have used those services. Hopefully you're not using Wonga because you've financed your MBA, something a little more long-term. Spotify, you may be a subscriber, streaming music, and the list goes on. And Accel has been investing in technology businesses for about 25 years, initially out of Silicon Valley, but nowadays out of Silicon Valley, London, India, and also in China. We manage about $8 billion, and all of that is focused on technology-based investments of some form or another. Current focus areas for us, mobile applications, gaming, technology-enabled commerce, cloud infrastructure, and we're also investing from the very earliest seed stages of business through to much more mature growth stage businesses. And that's the end of the shameless plug. So, question one, should you seek funding? Most people, surprisingly, don't actually stop to think about this, but I do think it's a very important question. And the question really is, what do you want to be? Do you want to build a large, high-risk, high-return, rocket ship kind of business? Or are you interested in something which is a bit more lifestyle-oriented? Funds a very pleasant life, but means you can take the phone calls on the beach, you're in control of your own destiny, much more than you are in the rocket ship kind of scenario. Venture investors are interested in the left one, but not in the right one. Why? Because business startups are inherently high risk. There's a lot of uncertainty. And if we're going to put our capital and our investors' capital to work in these kinds of businesses, the reward has to match that. So ask this question seriously, because once you set off on this road, it's very difficult to go from the left model to the right model. Another comment about what I'm going to talk about tonight. I think you can represent businesses in really three very high-level stages. At the beginning, the early life of the business, you're trying to determine whether the product or the service that you offer actually fits the market, if it actually does something that people value. Later, you're trying to define a repeatable sales model. So if you've sold one, can you sell two? Can you sell four? Can you sell 10? And can you do that profitably? And then later in the life of the business, you really, if you're on the rocket ship model, how fast can I build this? How quickly can I accelerate? Can I dominate my market? Can I beat my competition? For tonight's purposes, and I think probably more appropriately given the audience that's here in the room, the bottom one is where I'll focus, the very earliest stages of business creation. Okay, so let's take a step back and look at the fundraising process as a whole. I've tried to break this down into five different phases here. Preparation, presentation, a period of what we call due diligence, which is where an investor starts to understand your business properly. If they like it, there's a period of negotiation where you try to reach an arrangement, a deal about how to invest. And then there's the legal process, which is really documenting that headline set of agreements. Yeah. Presentation, as I telling your story, a little bit more on the due diligence piece. In the presentation phase, most investors will say, OK, I'm going to assume this is all true. I'm going to assume that the entrepreneur's assumptions hold. I'm going to assume that the market is what they say it is. Does it sound like an interesting story? Does it sound like a good fit for me? And if that all makes sense, then you can enter a due diligence period. And there are two approaches to due diligence. One is what's known as confirmatory due diligence, where the goal is for the investor to validate that the story makes sense and has a good chance of success. I think there's a richer way of doing this, which is much more of a conversation and a dialogue between the investor and the entrepreneur, which is to say, this is the model that you've come up with. Now let's apply the benefit of my years of experience to this model, and let's see if together we can create something bigger, lower risk, more exciting, more likely to succeed. And I think my sense is, and my experience is, that that can be as valuable for the entrepreneur as it can be for the investor, even if there's no commercial deal at the end of it. Good investors will make you think really hard, ask you difficult questions, and ultimately you end up with a better outcome at the end of it. The negotiation phase is really where the investor has said, okay, I think I want to invest in this business. Let's see if we can come to some kind of commercial arrangement. And the tip I'm going to give you on this one is, typically, let me bring the next one up. Typically, during the due diligence phase, your investor may have said, look, I think I can invest in this on these kind of terms. Does that sound like something that makes sense to you? Before they'll get into the really, really detailed discussion about due diligence. And if that makes sense, then they start to work towards what's known as a term sheet. A term sheet is a document, five or so pages in length, which sets out the key terms of investment. And the tip that I want to leave you with here is that that is the time to get into the detail. You see sometimes term sheets which are one page in length, which have the headline terms only and none of the detail, which you typically need to implement in legal documents. And it's much more efficient, if you get to the term sheet stage, to negotiate at that stage than it is to come up with a lightweight, headlines-only term sheet and then engage with lawyers and so on to document the rest of it. It's much more efficient to do it yourselves. So that means you have to learn, you have to invest the time to understand what the various components of a term sheet are. I'll talk a little bit about that later. So that's what a good process looks like. One to avoid, if you're in this phase, is the one where an investor says, this is kind of interesting, I'll negotiate first, I'll put down some headline terms, we'll sign a headline term sheet, and in that process, you sign up to a thing that's known as exclusivity. Exclusivity means that you're only going to talk to me. You commit not to talk to other investors during that process. This is bad for you as an entrepreneur. You lose control of the process, you lose the ability to talk to other investors, and you lose a lot of your negotiating power. So avoid that one. Okay. So if we talk about the preparing and pitching part of the process, in my mind, this is a process of addressing some very key questions. And the process of answering those questions are as valuable for entrepreneurs as they are in the process of just writing them down and documenting them. Do your customers really recognize the problem that you're trying to solve? Do they know that they've got that problem? Because so many times you see technology startups addressing a problem or producing a technology which they think is really cool and excites them because they're interested in the science or the engineering or writing some software or whatever it is, but actually doesn't solve a problem that anybody actually cares about or much less is willing to pay for. So this is a very important part. It's the product market fit. Then there's a question of, okay, if this is interesting to some people, how many people are there who have this problem and recognize they have the problem? And if there was a solution to that problem, would they be willing to buy it? Would they be willing to pay good money for it? And how much would they pay? Then would they buy it from you, or is there an alternative source? Can they cobble up some alternative solution which is more effective for them? And if they would be willing to buy it from you, how would they find you? How would you advertise? How would you reach the customers? Would they come to you? Would you have to go to them? What are the established ways of doing business in the kind of industry that you're interested in? And then last, and I very deliberately put this at the bottom, if you can solve the problem, can you build a commercially viable solution to that problem? And I've very deliberately put it at the bottom because it doesn't matter. I call them sprocket-fangled widgets, features, product features, lovely pieces of technology, beautiful graphics, beautiful product design, if there's actually nobody who cares about what you do. And if there's a book that I'll talk about later, which I think is worth reading, which talks about the lean startup, which explores the concept of the... I've got the name of the book later on in the deck, so you don't have to write it down. Which talks about the concept of the minimum viable product. What is the thing that you can put in front of customers that they're actually willing to buy that tests this product market fit concept? And there's some other things which I haven't put up here, which were in the first lecture in this series, which they're things that you should include in a business plan or a presentation to investors. Your business model, the cash flows, the P&L, the profit and loss statement or income statement if you come from the US. What is the funding need? How much money do you need in order to fund the whole business? How much money do you need to get to the first proof points? For example, your demonstration that you've got a product market fit. And what are the key milestones along the way which give investors confidence that you're actually going to achieve what you set out to achieve? They all need to be there, but I think they're actually less important ultimately than answering these questions. So if we go through and answer those questions, ultimately you need to translate the answers to those into a document. And my advice to you would be that document should be short. It needs to be focused. It needs to be ideally no more than 20 slides. I think earlier in this series, the first lecturer talked about the business plan as a document, a readable piece of text. In my experience, that's actually quite rare. Most of the startups that we fund have really two pieces of document. One's a slide deck, a presentation, which is short and typically has this 20 or so slides, plus a whole lot more stuff in backup in the event that somebody asks a question that needs a graphical explanation. And the other piece is usually a big spreadsheet, a business model, which contains all the assumptions about revenue, about costs, about user adoption, customer adoption. And those two things together are usually enough, with the right people wrapped around it and the right idea, to get the first funding. So as well as being short, I think there's a huge amount of value in keeping it really simple. And very few business ideas are actually simple. But the process of focusing down onto the key elements, the few things which really, really matter, forces a focus and clarity of mind, which makes it easier for you to explain, easier for you to focus on the key things that matter, and not to spend time and energy on the things which are less important. And I also think that it's important that presentations flow. This is an easy thing to say. It's an easy concept. Stories should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You set out, you tell them what you're going to say, you tell them what you said, kind of structure. But many, many, many of the presentations I've seen don't have that clarity, that discipline, which makes them difficult to understand. And when you're an investor who's seeing many people every day, the ones that stand out are the ones that get the entirety of their message across in a clear way. Doesn't matter how clever the underlying thing is. If you can't communicate it, we're never going to understand it. There's a book that I'll refer to here, Presenting to Win. It's written by a guy called Jerry Weissman. He's a former TV producer. He's based in Silicon Valley. And he's been behind the IPO roadshows, initial public offering roadshows of hundreds of startup companies as they take their first steps from the private markets into the public markets. It's the best book I've seen on how to present a business story in a compelling way to investors. So if you're going to do this, that's the book I would go to and read. It's not prescriptive. It's a process, not a set of rules that you follow. But you'll find it very helpful in communicating your story. the author's name is in the back of this deck as well. And then the final thing here is practice. Every time they tell the story, whether it's to your friends, to the mirror, to your teddy bear, to advisors and other people in the business, you'll get better at it. You'll start to understand what's good, what's not. Practice, 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 and then practice more. And every time you pitch to an investor, that's a practice session. It's an opportunity to learn. Networking. How many people here enjoy networking? How many people know what I mean by networking? Yeah, okay. So networking is the process of going out and meeting people who might be useful to you for the simple purpose of going and meeting people who might be useful to you. And the reason it's really important is that as investors, we're very busy. We have a huge number of demands on our time. I work directly with 12 companies. I sit on 10 boards. Every one of those has problems and issues and things we need to deal with. And managing my time is very difficult. As a firm, we can talk to 100 companies a week, which is a lot. And any proposals that entrepreneurs send in to us cold by email or a phone call or in the post, unless they're remarkable, don't stand out from the crowd. And the best way to get attention from an investor is to network your way in, whereby you get an introduction to the potential investor from somebody that investor already knows and already trusts. And there's two reasons for doing that. One is that those people we trust have opinions that we trust, and then we're more likely to pay attention to something that's introduced by people who have a relationship with us. The second thing is that gaining what I've termed unfair access in this way means that you know how to get to people you don't know. And that's a very key skill in finding your very first customers and the best partners. So if you can't get to us, the question is, can you get to your customers too? So how do you do this? Well, it's hard work. it helps if you're a sociable kind of person who enjoys a conversation. But basically, the trick is to network with the people that we network with, the people that we spend our time with when we're looking for interesting investment opportunities. And that means other entrepreneurs, it means business angels, it means business partners, other people in the technology business. That's where we spend our time when we're not at our desks or with our companies. And it is the way to get to the investors that you want. So I've described this so far very much in terms of how investors choose the entrepreneurs that they work with. It's actually a two-way street. And a good investor-entrepreneur partnership can be hugely productive, and a bad one can be hugely destructive. So when you're looking for investment, choosing the right investor for your company is a very good way to spend your time. So the good investors should know your industry. They should have relevant domain knowledge. They should have a network of contacts of other entrepreneurs, of potential business partners, of potential customers, professional advisors, to allow you to get your business off the ground. And you should do your due diligence, do your reference checking on the potential investors as well. Talk to other entrepreneurs, people who've worked with them before, people in the field. Talk to board members on the companies that investor is invested in. Look at the facts. What have they actually done for the companies? What's their previous experience? Is the network that they offer real? Ask them to demonstrate. Yeah. Can you introduce me to somebody who can solve my marketing problem? Or I'm trying to sell through a particular retail channel. Do you know anybody in that channel who can be helpful to me? And a good investor will open up their Rolodex, their card file, and will provide a couple of introductions. Because if you're a great entrepreneur, then I want to be an investor in your company, and I want you to be convinced that I'm the best investor for you. And the best way for me to do that is to show you how capable I can be. And I think you need to be brutally analytical about this. There's a lot of extremely eloquent people in our industry who might not be anything more than eloquent. So check it out. Take references. look at the facts. And then ultimately, there's a personal chemistry point. An investment relationship can be lengthy. Our average holding period varies depending on the state of the market, but can be anywhere between 5 and 7 years. Now, do you want to be working with the same person for 7 years if you don't get on with them? I don't think so. It doesn't mean you have to be best buddies. You don't have to want to go and have a beer with them after work the whole time. But it does need to be a relationship where you can connect under stress, where you respect each other and each other's capabilities. Otherwise, you're going to have a challenge later on when things do get difficult. And most startup companies do go through a difficult patch, or two or three, do change direction somewhere along the way. And having advisors who will stick with you and respect what you're trying to do through that period can be very valuable to you. So I'm going to get a bit technical for a minute. I talked about the concept of a term sheet, the initial document that you would discuss with an investor, which is the headline set of terms under which they would invest. Bear with me for 2 slides. This is a bit dry. So, first and most important thing, when an investor wants to invest in your company, how much value do they think is there? What's the value of the valuation on the company? What share price will they invest at? I'm not going to go through all of the detail here because I think this is going up on the website afterwards. But you need to understand what valuation means, and this concept of fully diluted valuation is an important one. And basically it means that when you look at the company into which the investor is going to invest, what is, if you take every share, loan, option, things like that, and include them in the entity of what the company is, what is the value of that whole entity? Consider everything as part of it. And I'll come back to explain some of what that means in a bit. next point, who's going to invest? How much are they going to invest? Is it going to be one investor? Is it going to be a syndicate of two or three? Or perhaps a business angel network, which could be 50 or so people operating under one sort of holding entity. What is the thing that's actually going to invest? Then there's a question about what are they actually going to invest in? What's the security, the share, the loan, whatever it is, that they're going to provide the money and get back in exchange? Is there going to be an option pool? What's an option pool? It's a mechanism for providing incentives to employees so that when the company ultimately floats or is sold, they get a return. So everybody is an owner in the company in some way. And then vesting is how quickly do those employees become owners in the company. You don't give them the whole lot on day one because they could arrive, gain the shares, leave again tomorrow, and then you've got somebody who's contributed nothing but is effectively an owner in your company, and that's not a great setup because that means those shares are no longer available for other people who are going to contribute. Board seats. Now, who's going to sit around the board table? Who's going to be involved in the detailed decisions for the company? Most investors typically want a board seat. Certainly we do almost every time. Then there's a thing called anti-dilution protection, which means if I sell you shares where the company value is £1 million today, and then for some reason we're not as successful as we would like to be, and then we raise money at a valuation which is lower, say £500,000 next week, what happens to the investment that the original investor made? Was he sold a bad deal? Should he really have invested at £1 million, or is he entitled to some kind of compensation for the inability of the company to grow in value rather than decrease? And there are ways of doing that. Are there dividends to be paid? Hopefully not. In a small and growing company, you want any cash that's generated by the company to go back into growing the company. Are there any things called veto rights? as an investor, I want some kind of protection about what the company can and can't do with my money. So I don't want to invest today only to find that you sell the company tomorrow, because I'm investing in growth. I'm investing in the future. I don't want you to be able to wind the company up tomorrow. I don't want you to sell off parts of the business or to sell your intellectual property or to hire new management at vastly exaggerated salaries. I need some protection around what's going to happen to my money. And if things are successful, I also want the ability to invest further in the business, a thing called preemption rights, the ability to preempt funding round. And then, very importantly, there's a thing, concept of conditions precedent. That is, the things that need to happen between term sheet and signing the final legal documents, which have to happen before I'm actually happy to put the money in. And then there's this thing, exclusivity. I already talked about what's a good process and a bad process. Typically, when you sign a term sheet, an investor will ask for a period of exclusivity. That means that during that period, I'm not going to allow you to talk to any other investor, because I'm about to invest significant resources and I'm about to spend money on lawyers and maybe some consultants and accountants and things like that. And I want to know that if I do that and put in all that effort, you're not going to turn around and take investment from somebody else in a couple of weeks' time. The exclusivity period is typically 4 weeks or so. Long enough for me to do my work, short enough that if I get to the end of that and decide, actually, I'm not going to invest, that you've still got the ability to have other conversations with investors. So I've talked about things like shares and preferred shares and options and capital structures and all that sort of stuff. And maybe I should have done this before the term sheet thing, but I couldn't figure out which came best. So I'm now going to walk through what all that means, I hope. So let's imagine you create a business and you say, I'm going to create Martin's company and I'm going to do that with 1,000 shares. The number is a totally nominal number. It doesn't matter. And I'm going to do it with these things called ordinary shares, and I own all of them. So I'm 100% owner in the business. This is my equity, or your equity as the entrepreneur. And then the investor says, I'm going to invest in your company, and I'm going to buy a thing called preferred shares. In fact, I'm going to call them A preferred shares because they're the first ones. So in exchange for me putting the money into the company, I get my preferred shares. And then I'm also going to say that that means that you've got some shares, and I've got some shares, but I want all the employees to participate in the success of the company. You know, I don't have lots of cash. I can't pay huge salaries. But what I can do is offer you a piece of the future. So I'm going to create an option pool. in this case, I've said we'll have 500 options. So these are an opportunity for your employees to get, at some point in the future, the same kind of shares that you do, these ordinary shares here. So I've now got 2,500 shares, and that's what my company's post-investment capital structure looks like. 1,000 A preferred shares, 500 options, and 1,000 ordinary shares. So in rough terms, I own 40% of the business, your employees effectively own 20% of the business, and then you own 40% of the business. And that's not too different from a normal venture-backed company kind of post-investment structure. So what happens next? Well, you know, hopefully your technology works. You prove that your product has a place in the market. Some customers start to use it. Some of them even pay you money. This is good. And as a result, the value of the company increases. So we've still got the same number of shares as we had before, 2,500 shares. And if we said the share was worth £1,000 at the beginning of this process, then after you grow, maybe your shares are worth £2 a share. The percentages haven't changed at all here. There's still 40% in ordinaries, 20% in options, and 1,000 in preferred shares. And you can see here in the options piece, of the 500, I've already granted 400 of those to the employees that I've taken on during that process. But I've got 100 left. So you know, we're doing great. We've built some value. We can't actually turn that into cash for ourselves yet. And we need to raise some more money, perhaps to invest more in sales and marketing. Perhaps there's some more product development work to do. So we need to go out and raise more money. So we start with this capital structure, which we had before, what is now the pre-money capital structure, because we haven't taken in this new piece of investment. And we go and talk to some new investors, and they buy another 1,000 shares. This time I'm going to call them B preferred shares, and I'll explain what that all means in a minute. So again, this is shares purchased by investors in exchange for the cash, the investment. And you go through that whole, you know, prepare, present, due diligence, negotiate, legals process that we talked about before. And we also say, you know, now we've granted 400 of our 500 options, but we need to hire some more employees, so we need a few more options. So we're going to top up the option pool. And the best way to do that is to say, with this money, I'm going to need to hire 20 more people, and each of those people in these different roles are going to require such and such a number of options. Okay, that's what the option pool size needs to be. And by the time you add all that lot up, you've got another post-money capital structure. You've got these preferred B shares at the top, which are different from the preferred A shares. They may be different in terms, but they're certainly, hopefully, likely at a higher price. We've got our A preferred shares, we've got our options, the 400 granted that we had there, and then we've now got 350 available in this option pool for grants to employees and so on. And percentage-wise, that's what it looks like. So as the founder entrepreneur, you've now got 27% of the business, you've got this 20% option piece, and your investors have, what's that, 53, roughly, 53% of the business. And that is, again, fairly typical for what a venture-funded company might look like after two rounds of funding. Now, what I haven't explained is, what does all this preferred share thing mean? And this is the analogy that I think works best. We're in Oxford, so I thought champagne rather than beer. When you drink a glass of anything, you drink from the top, not from the bottom. And the way that preferred shares work for investors is that when you sell the company at some point down the line, the first money that comes out is this A preferred piece. So the original amount of money that the investor put in comes out first. And then everything else goes to the ordinary shares. And that's good, because that's you guys and that's your employees. And when there's this preferred structure in place, the amount that comes out on top is fixed. It's the preference, as it's known. So if the business is worth 10 and the amount of investment was 1, then the preferred shareholders, your A investors, get 1, and you, the founders, and the other employees who own ordinary shares get 9, the difference between the two. So this works well when the valuation is very high, because most of the money is flowing to the ordinary shareholders. But there's a wrinkle, which is that we very rarely actually invest in just the preferred share. Every share that we have is typically convertible between a preferred share and an ordinary share. And if we convert our A preferred shares into ordinary shares, then we sit side by side in the structure. So if we're drinking from the top, then in this right-hand picture, I'm getting the left-hand slice and you're getting the right-hand slice. So if the company's really valuable, then I might find that actually I prefer to convert my shares, and then we're getting, say, 50% each, that kind of structure. And everybody shares according to, if I go back up a slide, these percentages on the right-hand side. So the A shareholders would get their 27%, the B shareholders would get their 27, the founders would get 27, and the option holders would get their 20. And then that's one structure. That's called most normally known as a preferred share, or more accurately, a convertible preferred share. And then there's another one called the participating preferred, which is more beneficial to the investor and slightly less beneficial to the entrepreneurs and the employees, where we would get our preference off the top, and then we would get of what's left as if we had converted That's what's known as on an as-converted basis. So we receive the preference and then a share of the remainder. And this feature, if you like, is called a participation feature. And both convertible preferred and participating preferred exist in normal deal structures. And the only difference really is, and there's clearly a difference in structure, but whether you prefer one over the other depends on whether you're willing to trade off the value of your company at investment time versus the eventual value that you would see out of it at the end. It's a matter of negotiation. Should you take a higher share price with the participation feature or a lower price without it? And it depends upon the circumstances. There is no hard and fast rule. So those are the primary structures which you'll see in any kind of venture investment. There's one other thing that I wanted to talk about briefly, which is the concept of founder vesting. And this is one which is very difficult sometimes for founders of companies to swallow. And when we invest in companies, there are two things that we're backing. One is the idea, and the other one is the team. But then what happens if we invest, we put our £1 million in, and after a little while the team says, you know what, this isn't quite what I thought it was. I'm done. I'm out of here. This thing about founder vesting, which basically says that we'll invest today and we'll lock up your shares in this founder vesting structure. And over a period of time, as the value that you've promised to create is realized, then we release those shares. So you're free to do whatever you like with them. And the usual response we hear from an entrepreneur is, but it's my company. I created this thing. This is my idea. Now you're investing in me. And of course I'm not going to leave, but I'm totally committed to it. Well, that's usually the case, but not always. And this is another investor protection, if you like. We're putting in money on the promise of something, but with very little that's actually concrete. And if an investor, if a founder leaves, or the team leaves partway through that process, then we're left with a problem. So if we go back to our basic post-investment capital structure, if the founder leaves, then these ordinary shares here are cancelled. Now, if there's any lawyers in the room, they'll know it's a bit more complex than that. But effectively, they disappear or they go off into a trust for provision to other employees. And that gives us the headroom, without diluting our investment, to issue some new options, maybe to hire a new team to allow us to carry on with what we set out to do. Now, obviously, it would be without the founders, and that's rarely a good thing, but it does create the headroom for us to do it. So if any of you do start your companies and come up across this concept of founder vesting, that's why we do it. It's not intended to be unfair. It's really about making sure that the thing that we invest in can continue to exist. So those are the headlines. We've got 12 minutes. That was a bit of a whistle-stop tour, so I think let's leave the remainder of the time for questions. Just a quick recap. The questions were, should you seek investment or not? Some quick headlines about the fundraising process and the phases you'll go through and some of the preparation you'll need to do. A little bit about pitching, and then some of the headlines, again, around how you structure deals and what to expect from an investor when you have that conversation. It's all pretty high level, and the complexities do matter. But those, I think, are the fundamentals. So, time for me to step away from the pitch.